Putnam Berkeley Audio presents Everyday Grace by Marianne Williamson, read by the author.
Everyday Grace, having hope, finding forgiveness, and making miracles. A human being is part of the whole called the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in all its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such achievement is in itself part of the liberation and a foundation for inner security. Albert Einstein. Introduction. Reclaiming Our Magic. My father used to speak of the Byzantine rule, which is that nothing is as it appears to be. I've always had a sense that something is missing in this world, that at the very least, there's something important we're not discussing. I believe that that hunger for a lost dimension of experience is a natural yearning in all of us, and it doesn't go away just because we ignore it. It is evidenced, among other places, in the millions of children and adults who obsessively read the Harry Potter books. It is said that fiction is where someone gets to tell the truth. We are a bunch of silly muggles, and we really do miss out on the magic of existence. There's a collective knowing that a dimension of reality exists beyond the material plane. And that sense of knowing is causing a mystical resurgence on the planet today. It's not just children who are looking for a missing piece. It is a very mature outlook to question the nature of our reality. We are like birds who have forgotten we have wings, kings and queens who have forgotten our royal heritage. We feel enslaved by conditions that should have no power to bind us, and powerless before forces over which we have been given dominion. No wonder our children are drawn to reading about a world in which people live a more magical existence than the one we offer them here. I've watched my daughter bury herself, like so many other children, heart and soul in the Harry Potter books. I remember that when I was her age, I had a similar fascination with books like A Wrinkle in Time, Half Magic, and the Narnia series by C.S. Lewis. In a particularly passionate moment, my daughter once told me that the only time she was really happy was when she was reading Harry Potter. And, sadly, I understood what she meant. It was the only place she felt she could stay in touch with all the magic. When I'm honest with myself, I know that I cry deep inside, just as my daughter does, when I cannot find the magic. Emma has asked me several times, "Mommy, are the Harry Potter books true? Are there really magical places like that?" And I answer her as honestly as I can, which is to say that I answer yes. But she's never satisfied when I talk about different realms of consciousness, when I tell her that the magic in Harry Potter is a magic that lives in all of us. She wants a simpler magic, which I understand. And I assume that one day she'll find her own path to the magic that lives and breathes inside her. No one can take the journey for anyone else, as much as we might like to. But if and when my daughter makes her own mystical journey, she will learn that magic indeed is here in this world right now. It is literally all around us. Each of us has a mark on our forehead, just like Harry Potter, which speaks to the fact that all of us come from a very magical source. Harry Potter is one boy in a long line of mythical heroes who have reminded the human race that we are so much more than we think we are, so much more powerful than we seem to know. Jesus said that we would someday do even greater work than he. Should we not take him at his word? And should not someday be today? It's time for us to start working miracles, if indeed we have the capacity within us to do so. This book is for those who seek to work miracles. The search for the Holy Grail of miraculous power, humanity's instinctive understanding that we are meant to soar above the limitations of our physical world, has been going on for ages. Yet now, the search has become a popular yearning, not just among monks or adventurers in far-off places, but among many of us living very practical lives. We wish to cultivate the sacred in the midst of the great and small difficulties of our daily existence. We want spiritual principles to be more than beautiful abstractions. We want them to actually transform our lives. Heaven and earth shall be as one, according to the Bible, meaning that one day we will live on the earth but think only the thoughts of heaven. The intersection between our material and spiritual existence is the mystical power represented visually in both the Christian cross and the Jewish Star of David. It is the point where the axis of God meets the axis of humanity. The modern mystic is someone seeking to embody that point in his or her own experience. In the words of author Manly P. Hall, mysticism is not a religion, but a quote-unquote conviction of the heart. I realize now that the journey which started in my childhood, beginning with books about magic, then moving on to philosophy classes, astrology, tarot, the I Ching, and ultimately more classical theological studies and A Course in Miracles, has been a fairly common version of my generation's spiritual journey. I was once someone, and in the 1960s and 1970s there were many of us, who had moons and stars on the walls of every place I lived and encrusted in the jewelry of every outfit I wore. And we needn't discuss the Maxfield Parrish prints, the light, the illumination, the hint of another reality. I can see now what I was going for, however crudely, and I have compassion for the young woman I was, always thinking there was something more. Now that I'm firmly planted in my middle years, I can see that the spiritual path has been the calling of my soul for a very long time, and I am ready to devote the rest of my life to walking it as best I can. The seeker in us is always seeking more truth, knowing that the search goes on forever. The mystic in us, on the other hand, is trying to practice what we've learned of it right here, in this moment, whatever we're doing. The mystic is a spiritual practitioner, seeking not merely to understand the principles of spiritual awareness, but to embody them as best we can. We embrace the idea, advanced by both ancient philosophers and modern physicists, that the world is one. Everything connects to everything. Therefore, as we change, the world cannot but change with us. Modern mystics form a kind of spiritual underground in the world today, seeking to transform everything. We are everywhere, as mystics have always been everywhere. We come from every religion, as mystics have always come from every religion, and some of us relate to no religion at all. The mystical realm lies beyond all dogma and beyond the evidence of the physical senses. Both gentle and miraculous, it is a path through the darkened entanglements of human existence to the radical love at the heart of God. I have written this book as a traveling companion for the modern mystic, who goes through his day with the deepest desire to be in the world, but not of the world, to be walking with her feet planted firmly on the ground, but thinking with her head soaring powerfully through the sky, to live solidly grounded, but from a spiritual foundation, integrating within ourselves the consciousness of earth and the consciousness of heaven. Such is the mystic's longing. And that longing is not for ourselves alone, for as any one of us finds our wings, the entire world is lifted. The mystical path is not always easy, and my hope is that this book might be a bit of a map through some of its thorniest passages. I do not write as someone who has mastered the way, but as someone who has been walking it, though often clumsily, for several decades of my life. There are bits of information I've discovered on my way, pieces of knowledge and understanding that have made their way to me, as they've made their way to mystic travelers for generations. I have seen darkness, but I have glimpsed a little light as well. May this book shed light on someone's path, and may all of us enter the illumined door beyond which darkness is no more. May the darkened skies of the human heart be lit by the light of truth. May the mercy and the peace of God be upon us now and for all our days. Amen. Part 1. Thoughts of Grace. The Mystical Wands. The first thing a mystic needs is his or her tools. When I was a little girl, every August my mother would take me to the store to buy school supplies. First, there was the important decision to be made about my lunchbox. Did I want Cinderella on the front of it? Or ballet shoes? Or Snow White, perhaps? And then, of course, there were the notebooks, pencils and pens, erasers, and myriad other accoutrements such as index cards, marks-a-lots, and notebook dividers. Only when I had all my supplies together was I prepared to go to school. Ultimately, I realized that tools are essential to almost any worthwhile endeavor. You don't go to school unprepared, you don't try to climb a mountain unprepared, and you don't walk the mystical path unprepared. What are the mystic supplies? They are spiritual principles, much like magical wands, in their capacity to turn any situation into a crucible of miraculous transformation. They change the world by changing us. The mystic path is a journey of personal transformation. And while the goal of the journey is to become our true selves, we can only do this by letting go of who we are not. If we wish to experience the fullness of life, we must cut through layers of illusion that hide the truth of who we really are. The mystical path runs through a very deep forest, the forest of our own psyche, and we need our supplies in order to walk through it. We meet monsters and demons on the inner path. We meet humiliation in order to grow to the point where our behavior would not lead to humiliation. We meet rejection in order to grow to the point where our behavior would not lead to the pain of rejection. We meet the pangs of deep regret in order to grow to the point where our behavior would not lead to regret. We meet the monsters in order to slay them. The only way to rid ourselves of darkness is by bringing it to light. All darkness in the world stems from darkness in the heart. The universe is holographic, which means the whole is present in every piece. Therefore, as we address the darkness within us, we are addressing the darkness of the world. The mystic does not deny the darkness in ourselves or in the world, but we affirm the light that lies beyond it. We have faith the light will prevail because we have faith that light is our true identity. Our task is to remember that. We invoke the light by actively acknowledging it is there, standing as Harry Potter stood on platform 9 3/4, knowing the door will reveal itself because of the nature of who we truly are. Being magic, Harry lives in a magical world. And, being magic, so do we. The mystical realm arises from a different mode of perception than the one we're used to. The human race now stands on the brink of a historic transformation, with new eyes, new ears, new minds, and new hearts emerging from the cosmic drama of human evolution. As an embryo becomes a baby, we are now becoming a new, more spiritualized version of ourselves. We are growing mystical wings as we evolve, as any species does, in the direction that supports our survival. We are moving toward a universal compassion, because, if we do not, we will cause our own extinction. Each of us is now participating in a collective quantum leap forward in which our species will experience a fundamentally new chapter in human history. Fundamental change is not a casual occurrence. We cannot casually commit to the process of spiritual transformation. It's not enough to say, "Oh, I think I'll be a mystic this year." Mysticism is not a trend. Our entire being is called to the task, for the journey from density to light involves every aspect of who we are. Every issue becomes a spiritual one. Whether we're angry at the dry cleaners because they've ruined our favorite sweater, upset with a friend who has broken a promise, or frightened at the diagnosis of cancer in the breast of a best friend. Whether we're worried about the state of our marriage, looking for a new job, or anxious about nuclear bombs and terrorists in our midst, we are taking the mystical journey as a way of transforming the world by transforming ourselves. We're asking not for the world to change, but for the lens through which we view it to change. For what we see anew becomes anew. Each of us carries in the depths of our consciousness a box full of mystical tools, and central to our toolkit is the magical wand. A wand is not just silliness from children's literature. Fairy tales are rife with archetypal truths that teach not only children, but open-minded adults as well, deep and fundamental truths about the nature of reality. A wand is a medium of power, not just for wizards, but also for you and me. A wand is essentially a principle, an intention, a focused thought. When focused thought is negative, it creates ill. And when focused thought is loving and enlightened, it creates miraculous breakthroughs. A mystical wand is the illumined power that emanates from a mind that is married to the heart. Most of us love, to be sure, yet far too often our love is passive. We must be proactive in our love in order for it to change our lives. First, we must outgrow the myth of neutrality. For in fact, there is no neutral thought. All thought leads to love or to its absence. One who is not committed to love is surrendered to that which opposes it, opening up the door to fear as surely as one who consciously welcomes that fear. There is so much love in the human heart, yet hatred threatens the planet. And why? Because it is more committed than love. In the words of philosopher Edmund Burke, "The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for enough good men to do nothing." Indeed, the forces of fear in this world are more disciplined, more courageous in a perverse kind of way, than are the forces of love. For hatred, as we know all too well, has no problem announcing itself and its intentions to the world. Our response cannot just be that we oppose hate. Our response must be that we love the world. Then and only then will love triumph, when the children of God don't just feel our love, but express our love. Our task, then, is to harness the energies of love, to actualize its enormous power in practical and meaningful ways. Love, too, must announce its intentions for the world, with all the passion born of a compassionate heart. We are a species that has everything, yet what we lack is what only we can give: conviction. It is the conviction to love that gives birth to miracles. In the words of the French philosopher Teilhard de Chardin, "One day, after we have mastered the winds and the waves, gravity and the tides, we will harness for God the energies of love. And then, for the second time in human history, mankind will have discovered fire." And that is how we will use our wands, directing the power of their fiery glow to the darkened areas of human existence. Everything we encounter throughout the day is a spiritual opportunity if we approach it with love. Every moment challenges us to rise to our highest, to choose strength over weakness, forgiveness over blame, faith over faithlessness, and love over fear. In choosing love, we are choosing to be healed from the forces that would hold us back. Love heals the world by healing our minds, for that which is healed on the level of consciousness is healed on the level of ultimate cause. The world will change when we change. We're living at a time when our technological power has so vastly outdistanced our spiritual progress that we are threatened by the prospect of global catastrophe. And yet, there is within us the knowledge, etched on every human heart, that indeed there is a power beyond the mortal mind, which can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And if ever there was a time to humble ourselves, atoning for the arrogance of human will, it is now. There is a ripple of rising consciousness among the peoples of the earth today as we consider the possibility that there might be a better way, a way the mechanical, rationalistic, technological left brain cannot access, which offers us hope that the mortal mind cannot. There is another way of knowing, another way of living, and another way of loving on this earth. This other way is a realm that is full of magic and miracles. It is a world more real than what we see around us. It is the realm from which we have come and to which all of us long to return. "As to me," wrote Walt Whitman, "I know of nothing else but miracles." Everything but miracles, in time, will dissolve in the presence of love. Our imagination is the womb out of which a new world will be born. Think of every situation in your life as being ripe for a new birth. See luminous energy emerging from your heart, extending outward to touch all things. Cast the light over your childhood home. Cast it over your physical body. Cast it over warring nations. Cast it over the entire planet. Cast it over the people you love. Cast it over the people you judge. Feel now a bolt of energy coming over you as you extend this light. Avoid the temptation to invalidate this image. It's not an idle fantasy, for the light is real. And now allow that light to flood your body, your blood, your bones. Allow it to illuminate your mind, your emotions, your relationships, your career. Congratulations. you have picked up your wand and begun to use it. Our choice, to stand within a field of infinite possibility, is our greatest power in any situation. Changing our mental perspective is much like changing the lens on a camera. In the Bible, it is written, "Be still and know I am." That moment of stillness is when our mental lens has a chance to refocus. And there, in a moment of sacred connection with all life, we know that only love is real. In the midst of war, we can quietly and powerfully know that peace is our natural state. In the midst of sickness, we can quietly and powerfully know that health is our natural state. To know I am is to know and affirm that only God's universe is real. This may mean we repudiate the testimony of our physical senses or even of our logical minds. This repudiation is a positive denial of the so-called realities of a darkened world. As we stand firmly within a point of light, though darkness might be all around us, the darkness begins to dissolve into the nothingness from whence it came. The attention we pay to the nature of our thinking, therefore, is the most powerful attention we can pay. Our spiritual victory lies in rising above the mental forces of fear and limitation, using our wands to purify our thought forms, thus attaining the power to heal and be healed. Such is humanity's next step. It is our spiritual task, our power, and our destiny. Wand number one. God can do anything. When I was a child, there was a well-known advertisement for V8 juice. Someone would drink something else and then realize, wow, I could have had a V8. As an adult, I've realized many times when situations have not turned out so well, wow, I could have had a miracle. I could have had a miracle, except that I didn't think miracles were possible. I didn't think in a miraculous way. I didn't stand firmly on the principle that God can do anything. In the words of A Course in Miracles, there is no order of difficulty in miracles. No problem is too hard for God to solve. This is a very important point to remember, as it's hard to have deep faith in a kind of sort of powerful God. Faith in God, however, is inseparable from faith in love. To say that there is nothing God cannot do is to say that there is nothing love cannot do. It does little good to ask God's help if we ourselves remain unwilling to open our hearts in places where they're closed. It's not just God's love for us, but our love for each other that paves the way for miracles. If we fail to express God's love through faith or compassion or forgiveness, then the problem is not the absence of God's power, but rather our failure to align our will with His. He cannot do for us what He cannot do through us. A house might be wired for electricity, but it still needs lamps if it's to cast any light. With every thought of miraculous possibility, the lamp is plugged in. The more we align ourselves with the principles of love, the more empowered we become. Children memorize the alphabet so they can learn how to read. We should memorize mystical principles so we can learn how to live better. And to live better, in this case, means to live in the victory of spirit, claiming for ourselves the miraculous power that has been given to us as children of God. It is our faith that miracles are possible, that the very fabric of the universe is miraculous, which opens the mind and thus the future to unimaginable possibilities. Dear God, please send a miracle is a powerful prayer for cosmic support. This earth is dominated by thoughts of fear, and we are conditioned by those thoughts to forget the power of our source. Having not been taught the grandeur of our heritage, we do not remember the grandeur of our mission. We forget that we have the extraordinary power to work miracles in the name of God. Illusion and fear tie up the Prometheus inside us. No, we cannot do this or that because we don't have enough money or enough talent or enough intelligence. We don't have the right credentials, the right looks, the right connections. No one needs to hold us down if we believe we're down already. As long as there are walls inside our minds, we're bound to remain behind them. If you think you can't, you can't. If you think you can, you might. And if you think God can. You are on your way to a life of spiritual triumph. You have claimed His power on your own behalf, which is what He would have you do. God is not stingy with His miracles. It's a pity we ask for so few. According to A Course in Miracles, we do not ask God for too much, but for too little. It's neither arrogant nor overreaching to ask for a miracle. Miracles aren't possible because of anything we do. They're possible because of the nature of God. We do not personally work them. Rather, they are worked through us as we open our hearts more deeply to love. The mystical heart is a loving one, and thus a conduit through which God naturally reveals Himself. We have a power in us, but not of us, that can miraculously heal the entire world. Perhaps the miracle arrives in the form of an insight that unlocks a riddle in your life, a reconciliation with someone, or the opening of a door that had long remained closed. Try as you might, your efforts to break through using your talents, your power of rational analysis, or sheer force of will had remained fruitless. It was only when you put God first, when your heart softened, you gave up your need to be right, you stopped talking so much and you started to truly listen, that some wall of resistance began to crumble. You had not done anything, so much as you had released the energies of self-will. You had asked in a way that God's will be done. A miracle occurred not because you caused it, but because you allowed it. In the words of writer Willa Cather, where there is great love, there are always miracles. Mystical consciousness is humble but self-confident. We're not relying on our own strength, but on God's. Science, technology, economics, military force, and social prestige, all of which are seen by the mortal mind as sources of genuine might and strength, might have the power to affect situations significantly, but they cannot work miracles. They cannot transcend the time-space continuum. They cannot transform the human heart. Only love has the power to alter the subtler vibrations of human energy, for love transforms events on the level of consciousness, and consciousness is the level of true cause. The world outside us is a world of effects, so to merely change things within that world is to ultimately change nothing. Only spiritual principle addresses the true cause of every problem, because every problem is, in essence, a spiritual crisis. Every problem reflects an unforgiveness. In every situation, the consciousness of love either has revealed itself or remains hidden. The role of the mystic is to find the love and reveal the love that lies latent in every circumstance. Terrorism, for instance, is not our deepest problem, but rather the effect of a deeper one. Hatred itself is our deepest problem. While military power might contain the terrorists, only love has the power to dismantle the hate from which terrorism emerges. There is no problem to which the love of God, manifest in our love for each other, is not the ultimate solution. A nation that puts money before love must address that problem first if we wish miracles to bless and protect us. It's not the word of God, but the work of God, which is necessary in order to call forth miracles. If miracles are seen as merely some sort of metaphor, then they're likely to have the power of metaphor in our daily lives. And how much power is that? Rather, we can see miracles as sewn into the fabric of the universe, and when we do, our experience of the universe is altered. When we are open to the possibility that God's power is truly unlimited, that in the ultimate vastness of the cosmos, love prevails, then we are automatically transported to a realm of possibility in which miracles flow forth naturally. Why should we so slavishly surrender to a fear-based worldview, which purports to have the answers to everything and yet clearly has answers to very few questions of fundamental import? The mortal mind can design a gorgeous wedding, but it cannot weave two hearts together. It can invent medicine to keep us alive, but it cannot create the will to live. And it can manufacture an engine of war, but it cannot create deep peace. Isn't it time to leave behind us the limitations of a mortal perspective and embrace instead the spiritual freedom that emanates from the mind of God? Is not the world in some way upside down? Does the mortal mind deserve the adoration it receives, and the mind of God such weak allegiance? I've been in many circumstances where it simply didn't occur to me to ask for a miracle. I would think, this situation isn't about God, it's about money, or work, or relationships, or politics. But any situation is about God because He is the fundamental ground of our being. We are either standing on the ground of our ultimate reality, or we have forgotten who we are, throwing the universe off kilter and making ourselves vulnerable to the forces of chaos. According to the ancient Egyptians, the purpose of our lives is to preserve order in the cosmos. We begin by preserving order within ourselves, as each one of us, quite literally, according to modern science, is the center of the universe. Our relationship with God is our relationship with ourselves, for in no way are we separate from Him. Aligned with Him, we are firm within our own power, which is His. Thinking ourselves separate from Him, we are cast into internal chaos and fear. To know we are one with God is to know that we ourselves are infinite love. When we are not loving, we are literally not being ourselves. Infinite love is not an attribute of our being, but rather it is the essence of our being. Our only real problem is that we forget who we are. When we forget that we are love, we forget to love. And it is choice, not identity, that determines our experience. Should we wish to feel God's mercy, we must choose to be merciful. Should we wish to feel God's peace, we must extend God's peace. And should we wish to feel forgiven, then we must forgive. It was not just the power of God, but the willingness of Moses to receive it that caused the Red Sea to part. It was not just the grace of God, but the willingness of Jesus to receive it that caused His resurrection. And it was not just the light of God, but the willingness of the Buddha to receive its illumination that caused His enlightenment. A spiritual fire is sparked whenever the heart of man meets the heart of God, and its flame will one day light the world. When we want a miracle, we need simply to ask for one. In asking for a miracle, we are asking for a divine intercession, inviting the Spirit of God to enter us and alter our perspective. It is useless to say, "Dear God, I want you to work a miracle, but I don't want to have to change my mind about anything." The law of cause and effect is an immutable law of the universe. God will not intervene between our thoughts and their effects. When Cinderella's fairy godmother waved her wand, the fairy godmother representing the divine intercessor, as does Mary in Christianity, Kuan Yin in Hinduism, and Tara in Buddhism, a shimmering energy of golden light surrounded the object of her attention. We can think of this as transcendent energy brought to bear on any situation illumined by love. One perspective gives way to another, and the world is reborn. In the presence of the fairy godmother, mice turned into horses, a pumpkin turned into a carriage, and rags turned into a beautiful ball gown. Translated, people around us, once we've shown more faith in them, show up for us more powerfully than we had thought them capable of. A job we thought beneath us, once we throw our creativity into it, becomes the vehicle to a great success. Our lack in some area, once changed from a source of complaint to a source of thanksgiving for what we do have, turns into a source of joy. Overshadowed by the compassionate, faithful spirit of the divine, our lives become a space for miraculous new beginnings. And new beginnings are possible anywhere, for there is nowhere God is not. Cinderella's fairy godmother worked with what was there. She didn't call a car service and order up a limo. She didn't call Saks Fifth Avenue and say, "Bring me over something gorgeous." Rather, she surrounded what was already there with the illumination of divine understanding, and what was already there then miraculously transformed. Miracles change the world, though not always externally. They may or may not produce results as the logical mind defines them, but they always produce at least subtle breakthroughs in the energies at the heart of a situation. The word discipline comes from the same root as the word disciple, and the agent of the sacred is mentally disciplined to believe that there's no problem love cannot solve. Holiness is an internal state, a whole way of seeing. When our minds are no longer fragmented by the illusion of our separation from each other, but healed by the truth of our oneness, we are awakened to a new dimension of compassion. Within the mantle of that love, there is literally nothing we cannot do. We have remembered who God is. We have remembered who we are. We are whole at last. Wand number two. We are the angels we've been waiting for. Every night before she goes to bed, my daughter says a prayer which I too said when I was her age. Four corners round my bed, four angels round my head. One to watch, two to pray, and one to chase bad things away. It took me 40 years to understand what a prayer like that is really saying. Angels are the thoughts of God, and to ask for angels to gather near is to ask for God's thoughts to overshadow our own. To pray to an angel is to look to a level of pure thinking, divine thinking, and to ask that it replace our thoughts of fear. Such thoughts, of separation from others as well as from God, are distortions of reality, mental miscreations, and they lead us to conclusions and behavior that are destructive to ourselves and the world around us. One to watch. May the spirit of love tend my thoughts, guarding the holiness which alone should remain on the altar of my mind. Two to pray. May I remain in conscious contact with God. And one to chase bad things away. May my mind be ever alert to ways that I can cast out of my thoughts and my world the things that are not of love. When we pray to something higher than ourselves, we're not praying to something outside ourselves. Angels do not live somewhere else. Ultimately, we realize that there is nowhere else, but simply in another realm of perception. They live within us as potential conduits of divine power, latent but not yet actualized within most of humanity. In summoning angels, we're responding to the evolutionary lure of the angelic state. We are recognizing angels as spiritual mentors who can lift our thoughts to the heights of truth, and as we rise to meet them, we will ultimately become them. With this second wand, we remember that it is our own responsibility to live up to the divine potential God has placed within each of us as best we can. We have our wings, should we choose to spread them. In almost any situation, if we're truly honest with ourselves, there are ways that we can fly higher at fuller wingspan. There are ways to show greater honor and compassion to all life, to get over ourselves and serve something bigger. We are given as many opportunities to reconstruct the nature of our lives as there are moments in a day. We can think more insightfully, love more deeply, give more selflessly, and serve more faithfully the call of love. How many times have we regretted not having been kinder, or wiser, or more respectful to others? And how many times have we shown up lovingly for another person and been told, "Thank you, you're such an angel." Indeed. Angels' wings are not just metaphorical, any more than a butterfly's are. Just because they don't materialize physically does not mean that they do not exist. They are an actual energy field of cosmic probability, heightened in the presence of mystical understanding. They are higher thought forms through which we transcend limitations, flying above the earthly fears that would otherwise hold us down. Humanity is now challenged as never before to actualize our divine potential, summoned by history to expand into the dimensions of mind and spirit that will divert us from a most destructive path. This is not a time to wait for angels, but to actively become them. Indeed, we are waiting for something that is waiting for us. The distance between the lives we're living now and lives of mystical enchantment, between lives of material bondage and lives of spiritual freedom, is no farther than a decision to think miraculously. Each time we consider a miracle impossible or assume that we ourselves are not capable of working it, then we're choosing not to take flight. But that doesn't mean that we can't or that we won't. We will emerge from our spiritual chrysalis into the light of a new state of being when human consciousness has realized our capacity to do so. We need not wait for the world to become more mystical. The world is mystical. Our problem is not that the world lacks magic. Our problem is that we don't believe in its magic. We do not show up fully for life and then wonder why life is not showing up more fully for us. I've seen so many people auditioning life, waiting for the right relationship, or the right job, or the right house, before deciding to live life to its fullest. People say, when I've met the right person, I will show up fully in a relationship. When I have the right job, I'll throw myself 100% into it. When I've lost the weight, I'll try to look great. Well, imagine a narcissistic angel. The time to show up fully for life is right now, whatever the circumstances. The decision to be the divine attracts the divine. Life is a swirling energy of infinite potential at every single moment, and we ourselves either activate or refuse to activate the mystical fertility of the universe. The only way to achieve an exciting life is to be willing to be excited and exciting. The only way to achieve an excellent life is to be willing to be excellent. The only way to achieve love is to be willing to be more loving. Who and what we decide to be in each and every moment is reflected back to us in worldly forms. Situations that just seem to happen are not necessarily random at all. With every thought, we ourselves decide whether to welcome God's universe and its miraculous prospects. As we convert our thinking, much as one converts an electrical current, from identifying with the material realm to identifying with the spirit, then our spiritual wings take flight. We are lifted above the limitations of the past, for when we approach a situation from merely a material orientation, we remain at the effects of material factors. But if we approach it from a spiritual orientation, we are freed from the confines of material factors. We are heir to the laws of whichever world we believe in. Knowing this, the mystic says, "No, I'm not buying into the notion that wealth and position determine my destiny. As a child of God, I am bound by nothing. No, I'm not going to stop pursuing my dream because someone else doesn't see its value. As a child of God, I have the power to make dreams manifest. And no, I am not wallowing in the victimization of a youth that did not go my way. As a child of God, I am able to transcend the past." The path to a transcendent sensibility is neither even nor easy at times, but the difficulty of the journey sometimes turns out to be its blessing. Indeed, there are ways in which the pain we suffered yesterday increases our power to work miracles today. For challenges teach us humility and faith. Having experienced the pain of a broken wing and having been healed by the mysterious mercy of God, we then fly again with a distinctive grace. No matter what suffering has marked our lives, if we are open to a miracle now, then a miracle can happen. And there is no greater miracle than a person becoming all that he or she can be. We are healed as we begin to realize that we will be who we decide to be. And it's never what we're not getting, so much as what we are not giving that can actually hold us back. Whatever it is that we seem to lack will miraculously appear in our lives as we begin to give it to others. I once knew a woman who wanted very much to become a partner at her law firm. She was being groomed for the position. Yet as time went on, her hunger for partnership overshadowed her performance, as though waiting in the background was simply not her thing. She did not perform at her best. And by not living fully in the present, she actually doomed herself to the background, for she wasn't showing up more powerfully before she made partner, so no partners in the firm could quite see how she had the stuff it takes to actually join their ranks. She would have been better off with a little less worldly ambition and a little more mystical devotion. When we choose not to be an angel, the angels in our midst depart. People will tend to be to us what we have decided to be to them. Yet it can be difficult to shine on others when we do not honestly feel that there is light within us. But there is a light in all of us because God put it there. We can look to those in the world who have evolved to a higher level of consciousness during their lifetimes. They were not made of different stuff than we are, so much as they made different decisions than we do. It was not easy for Abraham Lincoln to be the Abraham Lincoln we revere today. It was not easy to be Susan B. Anthony, or Mahatma Gandhi, or Martin Luther King Jr. They were born, as all of us are, with potential greatness. But the actualization of that greatness was not predetermined. They could have decided to do and be otherwise. Whatever spiritual force moved within their hearts, luring them toward a magnificent destiny, is a lure that exists in all of us. There is no rational formula for greatness is not rational. On some mysterious level, despite whatever resistance they felt, the great are those who simply said yes at times when others would have said no. Fear did not deter them so much as it honed them. Something called to them from a higher place, and they responded to what they heard. Humanity has evolved to a defining moment in our existence. We can remain who we are and sink further into the troubled world we already made. Or we can allow our hearts to crack open like a cosmic egg, out of which will emerge a transformed creature, our own true selves. Look at it closely, in yourself and others, and tell me that creature does not have wings. Wand number 3. Every thought of judgment blocks the light. When I was a little girl, anytime I would ask my mother something mundane, such as, "Are we going to go out to dinner tonight?" or "Are we meeting Daddy at the zoo?" she would answer with a particular phrase, "God willing." I never thought much of it when I was a child, but as I grew older, it struck me how right she was. How often have people assumed this or that was going to happen, only to find themselves experiencing something very different indeed? You think you're going out to dinner tonight, but what's really true is that if something horrible like a car accident en route to the restaurant doesn't happen, then you're going out to dinner tonight. You think you're going to do this or that, but what you really mean is, if something out of my control doesn't interrupt my plans, then I'm going to do it. All of us are aware that God has to agree with our plans, or our plans will come to naught. When my mother said, "God willing," she was instinctively showing humility before the power of God. She knew it wasn't a good thing to assume that human will can totally control anything. And in saying "God willing," she was also praying that God would be willing, that God would bless our plans. I think she had all the bases covered. In my parents' house, God was a given. I grew up to appreciate the meaning of the word awe as applied to the Spirit of God. And that sense of awe has stayed with me all my life. As years have passed, my awe before the mystery of God has only increased. And I've moved from the realization that God is always present in my life to the realization that He's always interested in it as well. He's not a passive but an active force, and there is nowhere He is not. A God who created the world as one, perceives it as one, and loves it as one. His hand is in the tiniest details, whether they're a million miles away or right at the tip of my nose. His creation is a panoply of radiant genius, reaching from the smallest wildflower to the mystery of quarks. The completely solid field of His presence, covering every aspect of existence, could not include you and me. Forget the idea that God has more important things to think about than you. This thought is not humble, but actually a thinly disguised arrogance. Could the Lord of the universe work at anything less than full capacity, surveying just some, but not all of His creation? You will know that to God you are everything when He has become everything to you. He is incapable of withholding love, for He is love. God's infinite and imperturbable love is ever at work, creatively furthering the enhancement of good, everywhere and all the time. God has a plan for your life, and all life, which is perfect and unassailable. There is only one thing that can keep it from finding its way to your door, and that is you. As children of God, we've been given free will. We can think with Him or not think with Him. But we cannot limit the creative power of our thoughts. When our thoughts are thoughts of love, then we are aligned with and receive His power. When our thoughts are judgmental, then we are choosing to turn our backs on God. We can no longer see the light He is shining on us when we stop shining it on others. Cinderella's fairy godmother did not say to Cinderella, "That stepmother of yours is such a bitch, we'll show her." She could not have said that, or even thought it, and retained her mystical power. But, you might say, the stepmother was so mean to Cinderella, and the stepsisters were almost as awful. Doesn't the stepmother deserve to be judged? Notice that the fairy godmother obviously registered the fact that the stepmother was out of line, or she would not have stopped by in the first place. Clearly, she thought the situation needed to be rectified, or she wouldn't have brought her wand. But the fairy godmother was too wise to take sides. The archetypal wicked stepmother lives in all of us as much as Cinderella does. And she's not where we are bad. She's where we are wounded, divorced from our true nature. The fairy godmother came to heal, not to judge. Cinderella's refusal to surrender to thoughts of retribution is part of what drew the fairy godmother to her in the first place. Hate can summon the powers of the world, but only love can summon the powers of God. It takes tremendous faith in the power of love to refuse to hate those who behave in hateful ways. Yet in that refusal lies our mystical power. It can be very hard to show love to people who are not showing love to us. But God's love is our essential identity, regardless of how we act. The miracle worker remembers a part of someone that they themselves have forgotten. People deserve love not because of what they do, but because of who they are. When someone has forgotten their love, they have fallen asleep to who they are. Our mystical challenge and our power lies in choosing to remain awake. No one was ever born to hate. God's love in our hearts cannot be destroyed, but only temporarily put to sleep. We must know this and refuse to forget it. The perception of someone's innocence is a choice we make, based not on our opinion of them, but on our knowledge of God. The realm of personality is not the realm of spiritual truth. While we can choose to remain in the realm of personality, where there are always people making mistakes, it is not a realm of miracles. The perception of guilt will always breed fear, and the perception of innocence will always breed love, for all minds are joined. Anytime we project guilt onto someone else, we are fortifying the experience of guilt within ourselves. Like blood on Lady Macbeth's hands, we cannot remove our own guilty feelings as long as we're judging others. So whenever you're angry, ask for a miracle. Ask to experience your own angelic nature, that you might see beyond someone else's behavior, to the angel, however wounded, within them. Given the unity of all souls, what we do to others and what we think about others boomerangs back to us. If we wish to feel peace, then we must wish peace for others, and whatever punishment we wish upon others, we subconsciously attract to ourselves. Withholding judgment is a powerful wand because often people show us what we invite them to show us. If I respond to your guilt, you will tend to show me more of it. If I approach you with a critical attitude, then I'm more likely to get a response from you that seems to prove my point. Yet, if I respond to your innocence, you'll tend to show me that as well. Our focus on the good in someone, regardless whether or not our ego thinks they deserve it, casts a mystical light on any situation. This principle holds true, whether we speak judgmentally or even think judgmentally. Sometimes we feel that if we clean up our behavior, if you can't say something nice about a person, then don't say anything at all, then that will be enough. But it is not. Our thoughts, not just our actions, push keys on the cosmic computer. People telepathically register your real thoughts, regardless whether or not you're consciously even aware of them. Also, we don't get points for having little judgments rather than big judgments. Any diversion from love is a fundamental diversion from love. At the same time, we're human, of course. We're not asked to be perfect, but to be honest, to pray. Dear God, I have judgments about this person, but I am willing to see the situation differently. Please show me his innocence, so I will no longer focus on his guilt. Please make this a lesson in love and not fear. Amen. And there is a way to affirm the divine perfection in a person, even while responding to their human flaws. And when we do, when we choose to affirm someone's basic goodness, even when needing to share constructive criticism or complaint, we open doors to communication that otherwise remain closed. From an employer to an employee, for example. Excuse me, but this was not done correctly. Is not a particularly miraculous communication. On the other hand, something more along the lines of, I want you to know how valuable your work is and how much of a contribution you're making here. Also, I would like to have you work on this particular project this way. is very different. It's a statement that affirms the heart and therefore opens the mind, reaping the fruits of genuine communication untainted by resentment or fear. If our goal is simply to get something done, then we're often tempted by the delusion that our ego is the best guide to action. However, if we're interested in miracles, then we listen to the voice of spirit, which would have us put focus on a person's innocence before a focus on their guilt. This is sometimes easier said than done, but the ability to do so can make a tremendous difference. When we realize our mission is to love and forgive, we realize that every situation is an opportunity to do so. What we might see as a problem is looked at differently when we recognize that every event is part of a divine curriculum set up by God for our growth and healing. Sometimes our challenges in one area provide answers in another. I have a problem with a nasty neighbor becomes, I have the opportunity to use my spiritual power. Praying for someone is a way to resolve conflict. And we know that that's an issue for us and not just with our neighbor. I have a difficult employee becomes, I have a great opportunity to work on communicating without compromising my truth, but with fairness and compassion. And we know that's an issue for us and not just with our employees. I don't know what to do and it worries me becomes, I'm asking God to guide me that I might receive my answers from spirit instead of ego. And we know that's an issue for us, not just in this particular instance. Every situation that seems to be difficult is a lesson in becoming who we are capable of being. Every lesson is ultimately a lesson in forgiveness. Forgiveness is our decision to see the love that is real in all of us, despite whatever appearances to the contrary. Fear melts away when we refuse to affirm its ultimate reality. When we see beyond fear, it dissolves. I no longer blame you because I don't believe the part of you that acted out is who you really are. I relate instead to your innocence, to the angel within you, which remains no matter what you do. That is the power of forgiveness, to call forth a higher reality by acknowledging a higher reality. Think of the Israelis and the Palestinians. They are locked in war, but that is not who they are. They are one in spirit, as we all are, beyond the mortal plane. We will not find peace in the world by fixing the mortal plane, but by transcending it, knowing that warring peoples, in fact, are one. Holding to this mystical truth, despite appearances to the contrary, establishes a womb for the rebirth of their relationship, while they are having an understandably difficult time seeing the love in each other. All of us can help by seeing it for them. Because all minds are joined, deep peace cultivated anywhere is a blessing on people everywhere. What we do on the level of consciousness affects what happens in the realm of bodies. Far more than what we do in the realm of bodies affects the level of consciousness. Einstein said, we would not solve the problems of the world from the level of thinking we were at when we created them. Situations such as the Middle East conflict are examples of both our challenge and our opportunity to move our awareness to a higher level. Forgiveness is our mystical function, but it's often a gradual and quite painful process. Forgiveness does not mean that we pretend to like whom we do not like or turn a blind eye to the evils of the world. Commitment to God's love doesn't destroy our capacity for discernment, but the way of divine compassion, though not an easy path, though often counterintuitive, is the next step in humanity's evolutionary journey. It's the only step that will enable us to survive the storm of hatred raging around the world. God commanded us to love one another as a way of removing from our midst all that is not love. Jesus did not say, love each other, but only under certain circumstances. His kingdom, he said, is not of this world, and neither is ours. Wand number 4. How we walk determines where we're going. When Mahatma Gandhi articulated his principles of political nonviolence, he stressed that in all our doings, the end is inherent in the means. Now, this concept reverses the common Western truism that the end justifies the means. According to Gandhi, how we do something is as important as what we're trying to do, and ultimately, whatever we do will be determined by how we do it. Who we are as we go through a process, whether we choose integrity, faith, and compassion, or their opposites, affects the outcome of a situation more powerfully than the mortal mind admits. Love is a process as well as a goal. As we concentrate on being the people that God would have us be, a path of light opens up before us to ease our way. Circumstances begin to fall into more harmonious patterns as we find more harmony within ourselves. We can tell when a situation is in the flow, when we're no longer paddling upstream, when there's less stress involved in making something happen. The effort to align ourselves with the holy and the good is our greatest power to affect external situations. So it is that if we foster good cause, then good effects will ensue, not always immediately, but ultimately. In the words of Martin Luther King Jr., "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." There are laws of the universe that do not change. If we take care to honor the roots of a tree, then the trunk and the branches will take care of themselves. The mystic surrenders to the flow of God's love, knowing that it flows naturally in the direction of the highest good for all. There is a spiritual beneficence at the center of the universe. And as we gain, through experience, more and more faith in that basic goodness, we learn to give up our efforts to control and instead begin to deeply trust. It is not human will or personality we're trusting, or human machinations of any kind. Rather, we're placing our trust in the law of cause and effect, or karma, which is God's blueprint for the spiritual workings of all creation. The world is rife with human suffering. And yet there is, behind the worldly veil of darkness and fear, another possibility, a truer reality than that which we are living now. Our capacity to reach beyond the veil does not emanate from what we do, but from whom we are audacious and devoted enough to now become. That is why entering deeply into the still waters of God's love, through prayer and meditation, is every bit as important as any external action we take, if we're serious about trying to change the world. Mental and emotional agitation are obstructions to the flow of God's love into the world, reflecting as they do our separation from the peace of God. In order for the world to heal, human beings must realign our hearts and minds with Him. For in that union of God and human, the esoteric meaning of the Christ mind, a wondrous co-creative power emerges from deep within, bringing with it a blessing on all the world. This power is a correction of all our mental miscreations, restoring harmony and order to every aspect of life. When our minds are healed, the world will be healed, and nothing that does not vibrate with love will long remain standing. Love is literally the power of God alive on earth. It is a transformative, alchemical, miraculous force. And with that force, God is well aware of how to make this universe work perfectly for all of us. Yet often, we do not allow it, however strongly we profess our belief in God's love as our salvation. For God's love is not just His love for us. It is, most important, the love we give the world. The highest commandment is that we love one another. And when we make the extension of that love our primary goal, no matter the circumstance, those circumstances are blessed. We must take the actions that bring love to life, making it the organizing principle behind all our endeavors. Business should reflect it. Politics should reflect it. Education should reflect it. Everything should reflect it. Love is more than sentiment, and riding in lights across the sky is not enough to bring it forth. We must sow its seeds in the ground beneath our feet. Yet we consistently refuse to allow love to light our way. We resist the allure of love while we still long for its comfort. And what is that resistance, really? First, it's resistance to the experience of a bigger life in which our small and separate identity disappears. What is actually the birth of our spiritual identity feels to the ego like death. the ego, our small and separate sense of self, purports to be who we really are. But it is a false self. It resists our genuinely remembering God, because in the recognition of our oneness with Him lies the death of the ego and the end of all fear. Second, we resist love because it jams the rational mindset. The mortal mind cannot understand how miracles work, and for our entire lives we're taught to mistrust what cannot be rationally explained. Yet the fact that we cannot understand how miracles work does not mean that miracles don't happen. And while Western science argued for ages that the state of our inner being has little effect on the state of our world, even science today argues otherwise. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle reveals that as our perception of an object changes, the object itself will change. The relationship between our internal and external realities involves a quantum phenomenon inaccessible to the mind, yet accessible to the heart. We can safely place our lives in the hands of God, as His Spirit knows far better than we do how to turn our earthly existence into streams of radiance. Yet the ego stands guard, lest we break free of our self-destructive patterns. The ego, after all, cannot live without them. Think of the woman who is so intent on getting her boyfriend to marry her that she can't simply love him without an agenda. She feels the need to control the relationship in a way that's not possible if her only goal is the peace of God for her boyfriend and for herself. Her neediness, of course, does not bring her love, but in fact repels it. And think of the committed political activist who is so intent on fighting a wrong that he or she fails to honor the basic humanity of the opponent. Time and time again, the anger that feeds our political passions can be the very thing that invalidates us in the eyes of those we most wish to persuade. That woman would best realize that the future of her relationship depends on the state of her being as she relates to her boyfriend in any present moment. The activist would best realize that there's no creating a loving world except through our willingness to be the love we wish to see. Sometimes it's less important to know how the world works than to know how change works. We cannot change anything unless we ourselves are willing to change. For whatever problem we see in the world is only there as a reflection of our own internal state. We beat the Nazis, but the world is not yet rid of evil. We outlawed slavery, but our nation is not yet rid of racial tension. World War II could not end hatred, and the Emancipation Proclamation could not end racism. The deeper changes we are seeking to effect, in ourselves and in the world, are dependent on a level of inner transformation that no external force can dictate. That's why we must work assiduously on the process of self-purification. For what we do will always be infused with the energy with which we do it. We cannot give what we do not have. We cannot bring peace to the world if we ourselves are not peaceful. We cannot bring love to the world if we ourselves are not loving. Our true gift to ourselves and others lies not in what we have, but in who we are. I've noticed how different my day is, depending on the way I begin it. In the first scenario, my daughter goes to school, and I sit down with a good cup of coffee and the New York Times. I enjoy the coffee, the paper, and the morning time by myself. When I'm finished reading, I check my email, dress, and go to work. This is fairly enjoyable and fairly productive, but I realize it's guaranteed to maintain the status quo in myself and those around me. In the second scenario, I carve out at least 20 to 30 minutes each morning to spend quality time with God. It takes a little more self-discipline, but offers an immeasurably greater gift to my life. I light a prayer candle and pray out loud, sharing with God my hopes and fears that day. Then I meditate silently, entering the deeper waters of the divine. I am a student of A Course in Miracles, as well as a transcendental meditator, but I don't think it matters what form our spiritual practice takes. What's very important to realize, however, is that the mind of someone who regularly practices prayer and meditation is literally a different mind. I know this is true of myself, simply from my own experiences. In what ways am I different? Certainly I'm more serene, which affects all my interactions as I move through the day. Also, I think I'm smarter. I have greater insight. I view situations with greater depth. And my mind is not so cluttered with the meaningless preoccupations that bombard us every moment in this increasingly frantic world. My spiritual practice doesn't just make me feel better. I think it makes me a different woman than I am when I choose not to do it. Everything I'm involved with becomes infused with a peace I do not otherwise carry. It affects the reactions of people I meet and the outcome of situations I might not even know exist. We don't need to push life so much as we need to experience it more elegantly, to be motivated more by inspiration than by ambition. Sometimes we're so intent on moving up the ladder that we make compromises we know we shouldn't make while we're on the lower rungs. Yet faith is a ladder that leads us to new heights. We are here to do what God would have us do. Our prayer is to receive guidance, not only as to what that is, but also how to do it in any situation. We can remain in the realm of divine understanding, for our depth of understanding is the key to the life we truly want.